This is the Game Theory Today podcast, and I'm Eric Garland. This episode's very special and is going to eschew some of the headlines. Though there are so many right now, I could do 8 straight hours. Russians, treason prosecutions, financial crimes. I mean, the normal fodder for this podcast is ripe all over the place. This episode features a 1-hour interview with investigative journalist Leah McGrath Goodman, who has been studying the intersection of offshore tax havens and systematic abuse of children on the British Channel Island of Jersey. The bailiwick of Jersey is 5 miles by 9 miles, closer to France than England, books $2 trillion of offshore wealth, including that which belongs to Queen Elizabeth, the monarch of the United Kingdom. In fact, the island is a peculiar possession of the monarch herself, a term that will be explained by Ms. Goodman. Ms. Goodman is what I term a real journalist, one who dives all the way into stories and doesn't come out until the truth is able to be told to the public. Here, she has bitten off quite a bit to chew. The story of Jersey and its Victorian-era home for children, known as Hauts de la Garenne, is the intersection of vast amounts of the world's power, its most influential figures, and the discarded remains of abused children's bodies scattered throughout the island. This is not an easy story. As we approach some major themes explored in this podcast, treason, autocracy, injustice, and war, just for starters, you may find yourself asking, who is making the decisions that lead to the crimes and characters we encounter? Like many people in the world of intelligence, I know that the real story can often be a lot more brutal and unforgiving than most people are ready to hear. And yet it's emerging whether we're ready or not. Some people are decidedly not ready, as you'll hear in Leah McGrath Goodman's story of being targeted by some members of the British government for her work. Some are victims. Some are bystanders. Some are complicit. And some are more than just involved. Nobody is comfortable with the totality of this story. But as we learn what goes into controlling a world gone mad, our desire for comfort may be overtaken by the truth's own need to be heard. The story starts telling itself. And with that, here's the Game Theory Today podcast featuring Leah McGrath Goodman on Hauts de la Garenne. Joining us on this episode is author and investigative journalist Leah McGrath Goodman. She is the author of The Asylum, The Renegades Who Hijacked the World's Oil Market, has written about the origins of Bitcoin, and her latest project is a film called Dark Secrets of a Trillion-Dollar Island, Garenne, and The Heiress, the Queen, and the Trillion-Dollar Tax Shelter. How are you doing, Leah?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm lovely. So we seem to get into similar kinds of trouble. You like to write about corruption, fossil fuels, and cryptocurrencies.
And tax shelters.
So you're like me, but you don't write in all caps with profanity on Twitter.
No, I don't. But I do think in all caps and with profanity.
Such are the topics. Okay, so you get the respectable professional credibility that you deserve, and then I get what I get. So, but otherwise,
while you channel our id, is what I like to think of it as.
That seems to be what it comes out as. What got you into the business of causing trouble professionally?
I definitely never am looking to cause trouble. I'm usually looking to get a closer look at something that doesn't make sense to me.
Okay.
And so every story I do starts with a question or a series of questions, and they're usually directed at something that doesn't really add up on the surface. And I'm trying to find out what's actually going on.
Got it. So what took you in the direction of Bitcoin?
Oh, well, that was a conversation with my editor. He sent me an email early one morning and said, I wonder if you can't get to the bottom of these Bitcoin women. And I wrote back Bitcoin women.
Bitcoin women.
And he, yeah. And I wrote exactly what you just said. And he wrote, I don't know, but that where there's trouble, there's women. And so I figured, a typical newsroom sexist joke, which you get accustomed to over time. And so I said, right, you know, I'm not that into cryptocurrency, but I will have a look and tell you what I think. And a few hours later, I came back to him and said, it doesn't add up. I don't think that the official story and the real story match in any way, shape, or form. Mm. And that I wanted to look a little closer. And that is how that started. It was really just asking questions about the origins, the intentions behind cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, and talking to the very earliest developers who were directly in touch with Satoshi Nakamoto to try and determine what similarities across many of the developers were internationally based and as well as across the US. Hmm. And so talking to them and finding out what the consistencies were with this figure they were dealing with was the beginning of the work.
And the story just didn't add up.
Well, I didn't think the official and public story, which at the time the Bitcoin Foundation was saying things like, we're nonpartisan, this is a non-political project. You know, we know the Genesis block of Bitcoin contained newspaper article talking about, you know, banks getting bailed out, the credit crisis, what was going on at the time. And nothing about the origins of Bitcoin didn't look politically motivated. It looked very ideological. And so this sort of whitewashed version of what this was about that was emerging when I looked at it, and also who was involved, right? Very few people wanted to actually talk openly about what was going on and how developing unfolded. And there was also quite a bit of, you know, the different registrations for the website, the original website, you know, they leapt from, you know, originally Japan, and then they went to Panama and Europe and back again.
Panama.
You saw a lot of shifting. Yes. There's a lot of shifting of the early registrations. And I was able to shed light on some of that. But if you tracked it at that time, which was quite some time ago, right, a lot of blind alleys have now been inserted into what at the time was a pretty straightforward research process. Now, if I were to go in there, there would be a whole lot of extra things to sort through. It would be hard to tell what was real and what wasn't real, because as the years have passed, as we've seen, there have been lots of people claiming different things, and we'll see things embedded in code that weren't there before. You know, I'll look at even videos, and someone will say, right, you know, this person alleged this at this time, and here, you have to tell them, no, that video has been backdated, or it's been front dated, or it's, you know, a lot of things have now been meddled with to the extent I could see why some people would have a really hard time disentangling themselves.
So basically, if somebody has a quote official story that doesn't add up, they're going to end up in your crosshairs if it's interesting enough.
Yeah, if it is interesting enough, there's only one of me. So, of course, I have a long list of things that I don't get to look at day to day, but I never run out of projects.
Now, with your book, The Asylum, looking at the hijacking of the world's oil market, how did you get into, you know, fossil fuel markets?
I was quite young and starting out at the Wall Street Journal writing about commodities, and they put me on the energy beat, and I just found it completely fascinating. It was the futures markets were a world I'd never imagined, and the people behind them were just these larger than life, really amazing characters who, when I first wrote about it, my publisher sent me a note and said, are these composites? Meaning, like, are these pieces of different people that you put together to make them sound more interesting?
Wow.
And I said, no, these are real people. So I really enjoyed getting to know the traders, and many of them really were able to sort of lift the lid on how oil prices were set, not only in our country, but around the world, as well as things like gasoline and heating oil, propane, natural gas, which is like the big table at the casino, had some of the wildest price swings. And so I just got to know them that way. And I found out that the original market for oil was actually potato trading, but
the potato market fell on its own weight due to corruption. And so it was really those who kind of picked up the pieces and tried to create a new market that led them to energy. But I loved that this original kind of
it was the corruption in the potato market. Knew it.
Yeah, they were like hiding potatoes, and potatoes were being hidden in train cars so they could create scarcities. And there was a huge fight with Idaho, and then it defaulted in 1976. It was just this wild story. And when I was coming in, you know, in my early 20s in the 1990s, one of the market chairmen said, "Yeah, right. So your predecessor at the Journal used to always write about the potato default. It was so aggravating. They never would let it go." And I said, "Potatoes?" And he said, "Oh, no, now you're going to write about it." And I said, "Well, I am curious." So it was a very interesting dive down a completely different rabbit hole. But, you know, again, I really like to hear the human stories. I like to hear people's real stories about how they got involved in things that may or may not have ultimately led to corruption. And a lot of people enter these environments organically. There's usually a social culture around it. And, you know, if people aren't being honest, it's not as straightforward as let's steal and make some money. There's often, a very strong social network and professional networks surrounding it, where people are really helping each other and boosting each other. And once you're in, it's really hard to get out.
So, I mean, there's a larger philosophical question there. It's like, where, you know, what is the root of corruption? Not, you know, perhaps not just the human nature, but you're saying that there's... You may not intend to get into the crook business, but it just sort of socially pops up here and there.
I think a lot of corruption occurs organically, and people don't go in realizing how far it will go. And then once it's happened, they're already too involved to get out without getting implicated, right? I think a lot of people know with corruption, you may not be the person directly involved, but you might know about it. You might have looked the other way a few times. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different levels of enabling versus participation, but ultimately any person who's close to it or is aware of it may end up feeling like now they're a part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And so it's complicated, and it does often come down to human relationships where somebody says, "That's my family member," or "That's my friend," or "I'll ruin their lives if I say something." And so there is an organic component to corruption. And I really like to speak to people who can talk as openly as they can about how it all really went down.
The social component of whether you're going to tell the truth or not.
Yeah. And The Asylum was just a wonderful book because so many of these traders told me what really happened. So it was really an oral history of the energy market and what happened from its inception to the present day.
So in your work, you start digging out facts, and then people start wanting to tell you the truth eventually.
Yeah, I honestly am not a very judgmental person. I don't have any interest in morally judging the people I'm interviewing. All I want to know is what is the truth. If you were an axe murderer and I was investigating the axe murder, I would definitely sit down and treat you like a human being while you told me what you did.
Got it. Well, so, you know, with all that as with all those topics as warm up, you're in the thick of something pretty intense. And it looks like for almost 10 years you've been looking at the Isle of Jersey. A lot of the audience here isn't going to really know much about the Channel Islands. Could you do the basics down to even where these things are, where this island is, how big it is, how many people are on there, and how you ended up being interested in everything that's going on there?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about the Channel Islands not that long ago. And I was on a flight from London when I was living in London, right before the banking crisis, the credit crisis that we all remember. And I was flying back to New York, and I met a young woman who was married to a man on the island of Jersey. And she just told me the most wild stories about this tiny island. And by the end of the trip, I promised her I would go visit her.
And I said, I don't know when, but before the year's out, I promise I'll fly over and see you. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no one ever comes out here. It's just in the middle of nowhere. And it's a tiny island. It's 5 by 9 miles. It's 12 miles off the coast of France. Mm-hmm. It's actually closer to France than England. And when I first flew over, it's just a puddle jump flight. It really only takes about 25 minutes. You fly out, they give you your tea, you drink 2 sips, and they take your tea away because you're landing. And so that's how I first came to Jersey in 2007. And I really came to see friends. And over the years, a lot of my Wall Street hedge fund friends ended up relocating to Jersey because it has a very, very friendly tax regime for businesses and for those in finance.
And what years were people leaving New York City for one of the Channel Islands?
I noticed a lot of people leaving after the credit crisis, during and after, and I actually spoke to one of my closer hedge fund sources on the island and asked, why did you go to Jersey? And he said, I'd been in the U.S. for years and creating jobs and paying my taxes, but the IRS just would constantly try to bear down on us. And the paperwork got increasingly complicated, and I felt like we were always arguing. And he says, somebody approached him from Jersey and basically said, right, we can simplify the process. We'll welcome you. We'll make this a warm relationship. We welcome new business, et cetera. And he said, it was just such a revelation to have a tax system that treats you professionally and like they appreciate you being there. And he said, for him, it was just, he just felt the U.S. tax regime was archaic and brutal and punishing and extremely unwelcoming to business. And that was it for him. He's aware of the issues on the island of Jersey, which you and I are going to talk about. But he just felt for business, it was a much friendlier environment for him. And he runs a legitimate business, I might add.
I think that's important to note when you start talking about finance and financial regimes, that there's just so much scummy stuff that you can explore, but that lots and lots of, you know, even offshore vehicles or Delaware LLCs or whatnot, just because it's the same structure doesn't mean that you've got completely illegitimate ends. I've worked with clients that have operations all over the world, and they're like, well, where do we organize, you know, so we can pay tax? And, you know, which, you know, we do business in 7 countries, you know, not we sell stuff to 7 countries, but, you know, our supply chain's over here, our intellectual property's owned there, you know, what's easiest, what's most advantageous. And they're not trying to avoid taxation necessarily. They're trying to figure out what's, you know, ideal. They don't necessarily want to be the least efficient. I mean, that's, you know, a very rosy way to describe it, but it, you know, that does happen. There's also people who are trying to not pay taxes and starve society. You know.
And there's also people who don't care about paying taxes, but don't want anyone to know how they're making their money. And that's why they're going to a tax shelter. Mm. They don't want to have to say where it's coming from.
That's right. You know, it's like, I'd be willing to pay tax, but not willing to say that I use slave labor to produce cotton or traffic human beings.
Absolutely. I mean, we live in a world where there is a second economy underlying the official economy, and a lot of that has to do with trafficking and weapons, a number of things that are being fabricated, and it's making a lot of money, and somebody needs to put a place, and somebody needs to find a place to put it.
Mm-hmm. And that amount of money is sometimes hard to hide, so then that which starts as, you know, a friendly offshore, you know, well, you could do it here and, you know, we'd be easygoing, ends up being the no-till motel for uranium and, you know, heroin and stuff like that.
No-till motel, huh?
For money, anyhow. For money. So
you were asking how I got into Jersey. That was how I first started going over. But then as time went on.
You met a nice person, and then you start hearing about more and more people going to this Channel Island that's near cows, you know, in the cheese-producing northern part of France. And New York hedge fund dudes are moving there.
Yeah, and I learned that there's just, I went online and looked at the registry of businesses in Jersey, and I found this A to Z list of just all the biggest banks, every bank you could name, a lot of major hedge funds, really, really big companies, as you mentioned, like Glencore and Vitol and some of these places that are...
Glencore?
Yeah.
The Swiss commodities trader that's tied up with Russia and all them?
That Glencore...
Oh, that Glencore. Okay, go on. Sorry.
And the more I looked at different operations on the island of Jersey, the more interested I became, because I never knew anything about Jersey. I, of course, know about New Jersey, but nobody growing up says, do you know there's an old Jersey? Of course, we imagine there might be, but no one knew or talked about it. When I was growing up, you know, learning about geography, Channel Islands were never mentioned. And Jersey was definitely never mentioned. And so I learned a lot very quickly as I started looking more closely at the island and its financial sector.
But finance is not the only thing you found there.
Yeah, it was during Operation Rectangle that I started becoming very interested in the island. I was not reporting on the financial sector at first. I was just interested, and I had a lot of sources located on the island. It was during the dig at a children's home called Hot de la Guerre in 2007-2008, and I was watching it unfold, and that was when I started to see things I just had never seen happen before in any investigation.
In any investigation?
Yeah. I remember thinking, wow, I ran the global desk for Dow Jones for years. Mm-hmm. And you watch crime all around the world, like, sure, from an aerial view, all around the world, every continent. I just had never seen any investigation, particularly to do with crimes against children, where the police officers involved were being threatened and smeared and pushed out of their jobs. The health minister, Stuart Sivray, being pushed out of parliament, who was trying to defend survivors of abuse on the island. Watching the survivors themselves be threatened and silenced and told to just stop talking. Really heartbreaking to see. And then most of all, seeing that the evidence being found when they did the dig under the children's home, the children's remains, being literally described as things that were not children's remains. You know, we heard about what we call Jar 6, but it was initially described as a fragment of a child's skull. The island immediately moved on to this idea that it was just a piece of coconut, you know, shackles.
Hold on. They're looking into the abuse of children, and you're talking about they're finding the remains of bodies in this building.
They found children's remains, and a lot of them were fragments at that point, because what they found was a lot of it had been broken up and burned. And so bodies would not be what I would describe as what was found, although the British press lost its mind and just wrote wild headlines about, like, 8 more bodies found, 6 bodies being looked at, and it became like a mess because the press overdid it. And then the island basically said, there's nothing here. And so it became this, I just had never seen such a mess. And that was when I became more interested in how did the remains go from being remains to nothing here? And how did all these people involved in the investigation get pushed out? And what is going on? That's how I started to look more closely.
And what year was that?
That was the dig was 2007, 2008. And the following summer, I put all of my belongings into storage and just went over to the UK. I had a UK visa. Okay. A work visa. And I went over and just started doing interviews. And I thought, well, it's just a small island. I'll just do a few interviews. I'll have everything, you know, in a month or two, it'll be done. And that'll be that. And here we are 10 years later.
Wow. And you're saying there is a level of resistance that, as you point out, there's corruption all over the place. There's things that are politically embarrassing. But this seems intense and coordinated.
There has been a problem where anyone who looks too closely at child abuse on the island seems to suddenly have a lot of problems.
It will be maybe their job. It will be the police will suddenly raid their homes. It will be they get into trouble with a minor issue and then the government is taking them to court and they're being bankrupted. There doesn't seem to be a situation that I've seen where somebody's trying to look at the child abuse on the island and they're allowed to just ask questions and do their job. I have never seen anyone be able to do that without having incredible institutional interference, including me.
So were we talking about a few instances here, or was this a short period of time, or that these alleged events took place, or was it a longer period?
You mean interference, or you mean the crimes against children?
The crimes against children.
The crimes against children appear to date back to at least World War II, which the island has already done an inquiry led by a UK judge into crimes against children in government-run children's homes on the island. And that inquiry concluded in 2017 with the judge saying that she believes children on the island are still at risk and the island has an issue with accountability and addressing these issues.
All the way back to World War II.
That's the period they were looking at, because that is the reports went back a few, I think 3 or 4 decades of crimes against children went back that far. And Hôte de la Guerre, the children's home, and that's a French, you know, that's obviously a French name. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be the center of a lot of the violence that was being reported and abuse that was being reported. And as you and I talked about earlier, which we won't repeat here, the kinds of crimes against children, the word abuse doesn't even scratch the surface of what was happening to these children. The crimes against them were, to my mind, on par with, you know, kind of Holocaust level torture, like psychological torture, physical torture, you know, almost the terrible behavior, you know, pitting brothers and sisters against each other and siblings, friends. It was just awful. I mean, hearing about it, it's very hard not to feel your heartbreak when you're interviewing people who were subjected to the treatment they were subjected to on the island.
I mean, you're talking about, you know, finding the remains of children here. This is not this is not a mortuary. This was not, there was no medical anything in this facility. This wasn't a cemetery. This was a children's home.
Yeah, it was a children's home since Victorian times.
So these would be major problems, but it sounds like the institutions are not just not interested in getting into it, they have an active immune response so that, you know, nobody talks about it. I mean, have you ever been targeted for your activities?
Well, in terms of trying to report out and do interviews into abuse on the island, specifically related to Hôte de la Guerre. Yes, a year or two after I began, you know, investigating, and initially I just would go to the island and meet with people pretty quietly, but I ended up the island is a very wealthy tax shelter, and so the hotels are expensive mm-hmm. over time. So I decided, well, I'll just get a flat. It's a non-domiciled flat, so it's a flat that's allowed for foreigners. They have different classifications for that on the island.
Let me guess, you're not allowed to have a bank account there.
You are if you have a flat.
Interesting, okay.
Yeah. You'd be amazed at how easy it is to set up an offshore bank account.
Huh, okay.
That being said, when I was going through immigration to get my final approval, they were like, right, that's great, you're a journalist, you're going to be writing a book. And what is the book about? And I said, I'm looking at Hôte de la Guerre and the children's home. The immigration officer turned white. He left the room. He brought his boss in. This was while I was still on the island. And they both shouted at me that I needed a writer's visa if I wanted to write about anything on the island. And I said, just a minute ago, you were approving my flat and my work. I have a visa already. I have a sufficient visa for what I'm doing. And they said, no, you have to listen to us now. And I said, okay, fine. You know, I'm going to fly home. I will check with the consulate. And when I did exactly that. I went to New York. I checked with the consulate, and they told me a writer's visa was no longer available in the United Kingdom, that they didn't do it, and it had been discontinued.
So the only way you could write about this thing is if you obtained a bit of bureaucratic paperwork that no longer existed.
Exactly. So I got the business visa. Yes. So to make it very short, I got a business visa, which was approved by the consulate for what I was doing. I flew back. And as I was flying back, I was flying into Heathrow Airport. It was September 2011. And they just said, Ms. Goodman, can we ask you some questions? And I thought, oh, okay. No, that had never happened before. They brought me into...
This was at Heathrow or back
Heathrow.
At Jersey? Okay.
So Heathrow is where you are brought in to the quote-unquote realm. There's no further passport check. So Heathrow handles Jersey immigration as well as UK. Yeah. So I came in through Heathrow. They brought me into a little room in the basement. They said they were going to ask me some questions. Instead, they locked the door and started photographing me, taking my fingerprints. And I, of course, said, what is going on?
Were you allowed to have an attorney present?
Wasn't allowed to. No, no.
Did they tell you why they were keeping you in a little room in the basement?
No, they said they were going to come back to me soon. And so I was left in this basement, and it's just this windowless basement. There's actually footage on my website of my surveillance footage of me in this little room. You can find it on leahmcgrathgoodman.com. It's if you scroll on the pictures along the top of the website, you'll see it. Yes. So what ended up happening was they locked me up. They let me sit there for, I would say, maybe 9 hours. It was awful. I had no idea what was going on. I did ask for an attorney. I did ask to call my embassy. They laughed and they said you don't have rights because you're not in the UK yet. You're on the border. And I learned afterward that UK border is a black site, meaning they can kind of do whatever they want. So I waited because what else can I do? And they interrogated me about the island. What I found out was they were waiting for instructions from Jersey. And the reason I found this out is because I filed, I don't know how many pieces of paperwork for every single piece of data I could get about why I was being detained afterward. And it shows communications between Heathrow and Jersey, where Heathrow's like, yeah, we have her. What do you want us to ask? And Jersey's, you know, scrambling because it's a weekend and they don't have anyone at the office. And
it's like the government of the regional. Actually, what is Jersey a territory, a crown dependency, or is just part of England? What's the status there?
It's a peculiar possession of the British crown. So it is not part of the UK. It is really it's like a belonging of the Queen's. In a very strange way.
Oh.
Which is why it's called a peculiar possession.
A peculiar possession. That's a very... Okay, so... But yes. So these would be people who work for the Queen of England who are deciding what to do with your case.
I suppose the Lieutenant Governor, who is the Queen's representative on the island, I did see he was involved. So... Yes, but more to the point, these poor officers in Heathrow Airport weren't really sure what they were doing with me, and so it made it very confusing for everyone involved, including me.
But they knew they had to do something.
Yes,
but they didn't know what it was.
Yeah, and they didn't know why.
And you didn't have a chainsaw running. You didn't have 4 or 5 shoulder fired rocket propelled grenades in your bags or anything, right?
No, in fact, they searched my bags, and I didn't even have my notes with me on this trip. They searched my bags, and I said, I have books and shoes. It's like nothing, it's nothing helpful in there. So that took a long time.
No meth, no uranium.
No.
No children in the bags.
Might have been easier if there had been something, but there was nothing in it, and it was quite boring.
they tried to photocopy everything I had, including my address book, which really upset me because those are friends and family. They kept calling my partner. I kept calling my partner, interrogating him. It was very strange. And they weren't even asking really very strategic questions. You know, they wanted to know where my flat was. They wanted to know who I was talking to on the island. But overall, it was just a fishing expedition and they didn't have a whole lot of direction. In the end, after 12 hours in the airport, they finally released me. A whole day passed, a whole night, no food, no access to sleep, nothing. And they then deported me back to the United States and said that they did not want me to return to the UK for 2 years. I didn't understand why, since I had not violated anything. Huh. And their official reason was, well, we think you might try to overstay your welcome. I said, but on what basis would you think that, since I've never done that or come close to it? And that just never got an answer. But I got an official letter telling me not to return. And I fought it, and there was a public campaign. So there were journalists who wrote about it, thank goodness. UK Parliament opposed it, and members of Parliament on the island of Jersey also stood up and opposed it. And the only reason I got my visa back was that they did a very good job of embarrassing the island into letting me have my visa back.
Huh.
And they did. And guess what they did? They created the first writer's visa in years, which was a very elaborate process with a lot of fighting and a lot of waiting. But they made the only writer's visa in existence so that they did not have to admit there wasn't one.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that there's a story there.
It was amazing, and I was very proud of it because I was like, I have the only writer's visa that's been issued in like a decade.
I mean, it's not like Britain has lacked for stories or scandal or who's that guy, Prince Andrew or whatnot? I mean,
yeah,
that dude, or yes. You know, framing up some Northern Irish terrorists. Or the things happen in Britain. It's an empire. There's messy stuff, yes. Right? There's even some financial crimes in London, right? I looked it up. I binged it one time. There's some stuff. There's also a few Russian oligarchs running around. But anyhow, you were PNG'd, and then eventually they gave you the special Liam McGrath Goodman official one of a kind.
Yes. Yep. And I still have it. Okay. And I got the call from Jersey, and it was. First, I got a note from the head of immigration begging for people to stop emailing him, and can I tell people to stop sending him notes, because one of the members of parliament put up a change.org petition, which had like the direct email of one of the head of immigration. And he basically begged me to make it stop. And I said, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, this is a weird situation. I can't tell people not to object. It is objectionable. And then I got a call from Jersey Immigration, and the man said, he said, Ms. Goodman, you're pushing on an open door. We have no problem with you coming to the island. And I said, well, I have a letter from you saying I'm banned.
That could be confusing, yes.
It was confusing. So they issued this visa, I got it, and then I was able to resume my work, which I've been, continued to write about Jersey for about a decade. And my focus has been on the child abuse issues as well as the financial corruption that we have seen taking place on the island. And there's a lot there. I find that the layers, they don't seem to have an end.
Okay.
So far.
Because I'm sort of tempted to like just dig right in. What the hell's going on there? None of this is normal. I mean, except in places where you're over an enormous target and they are afraid. Bureaucracies of that size do not react that way. And of course, like I said, it's not like the UK ain't got scandals that you can dig up. Of course they do. What's going on there?
I mean, they seem very protected. From what it's a $2 trillion tax shelter with, as we mentioned, like all these major banks, all these large hedge funds, all these really big firms.
Could you
right?
say that number again? I think people need to get that number. How How?
Yeah, $2 trillion is the estimate that I've gotten. And so occasionally someone will say $1 to $2 trillion, but, you know, we're in the trillions. And it's a 5 by 9 mile island. So you do the math on what that is per square mile and what that means for the people who have skin in that game. That's massive.
I mean, so that's more than the national GDP of Italy on any given year, I think.
I have not checked lately, but I'm going to take your word for that.
Global economy is $65 trillion. The United States is about $17 trillion of that. Depends. That doesn't, of course, include the second economy. Either way, trillions are a lot. And this is so there's $2 trillion flowing through a 5 mile by 9 mile stretch.
Yeah, and remember, the money's not actually even there. It is booked there. You know, there's very little actual investment on the island. It's a very idyllic, beautiful island with a little capital city called St. Helier, which is sort of thickly settled. But everything else is these beautiful, wide open spaces with manor houses. And so, you know, it's not like this deep, thick city going on. It's money that's booked to the island.
It's not Singapore. It's where at least it kind of looks like there's a lot going on, and there is. This is, yeah.
Yeah. So the city of London has long been understood to be really an amazing sort of engine for a lot of money that's going through England. And in addition, Jersey serves the Middle East, serves parts of Europe.
Yeah, there we go. Any Russia? It's very... Out of curiosity, any Russia in there?
Well, most recently, the story that you and I are going to talk about that I just published did have quite a few Russian links. So, yes, the answer is yes.
And the Queen of England owns this.
Yeah, the Queen of England is understood to bank on the island herself. And so...
can you repeat that again? This is where she banks out of.
Yeah, so the island has one of the banks on the island is called Coutts Crown Dependencies, and the Queen is known to keep her money there.
I have heard of this bank. All right. So
that's not the only offshore financial center the Queen is known to bank on, but Jersey has long held a special place in the Queen's heart, according to many people I've interviewed on the island.
Hmm. And just out of curiosity, what are the other places she tends to fancy in terms of?
I think the other major island that I've heard of where she has vehicles, offshore vehicles anyway, it's the British Virgin Islands.
Huh. And British Virgin Islands is, didn't Parliament in 2018 say that they have to start creating a record of the beneficial owners of the corporate structures there?
I don't know if I see that happening anytime.
Well,
I mean, that would be great, right?
I was just wondering if they had asked for it officially, not whether it was going to happen. But
yeah, I don't know if I think the request has been made now many times. So I don't.
Well, I'm leaning here. They did it in 2018, and it was supposed to like start at the end of this past year. Question is, they gonna do it? I mean,
yeah. I mean, BVI isn't a place that I have a lot of hope about personally. And so I don't look at a request and say, oh, right, it's going to happen soon. You know, I just don't think it's going to happen.
Starting to have some questions about offshore tax shelter places. Understood. All right. So the Queen's out of the British Virgin Islands and Jersey. You know, no doubt other places. So, all right. So You're over $2 trillion. Who are supposed to be the abusers at Haute-la-Garenne?
Yeah, so the children's home for the last, and the children's home was closed in 1986. We should just mention very briefly. Okay. The children's home it started as an industrial school for boys in Victorian times. And I believe it served continuously for children until 1986, with the exception of World War II, when the Nazis used it as a signal station.
Hold on. The Nazis used the place.
Yeah, the children's home was used by the Nazis as a signal station, and then there's more than that, but we'll dwell on that for a moment if you have questions.
We're just throwing some Nazis, all right?
The Nazis were preparing for the final battle with Great Britain, and they used Jersey as one of their major bases in World War II. And so underneath the island is a network of tunnels that the Nazis created to travel without being seen.
And doesn't Garenne already mean something similar to that in French, I believe?
Yeah, so my understanding, I'm not a French speaker, but those on the island have told me Haut de la Garenne means top of the warren, meaning a rabbit warren. Mm-hmm. And it got that name in 1960. I always wondered what warren it was referring to, but when I heard about the Nazi tunnels, I wondered how many tunnels may have led to Haut de la Garenne when it was still a signal station. And I don't know if there's an answer to that question right now, because a lot of those tunnels were sealed and are now being reopened slowly by historical societies on the island. So there are bunkers nearby, and we know there are some tunnels in that vicinity, but children who suffered abuse have talked about being brought into the tunnels on the island from all sorts of areas, including being brought in by boats into tunnels on the island.
Yeah, this is leading to a lot of questions. I mean, and you're saying you're saying there's still some tunnels that date from World War II that ain't reopened yet since the Nazis were chilling there?
Well, since they were sealed in the aftermath of Liberation Day when the war ended. So a lot of the towers, there's still many Nazi towers on the island, and those are sealed as well.
I kind of feel like there's a metaphor somewhere in here for like the 20th century not being entirely over.
It's a heavily layered history on the island, and the original reason for the investigation into Haut de la Garenne were reports from the sea cadets on the island about abuse on boats of children out into international waters, which had been discussed for years before the investigation started in 2007. So, you know, this idea of children being brought into tunnels from boats or being brought out onto boats, children at the children's home who reported being put onto boats against their will and abused. And so there seemed to be somewhat of an active environment for abuse of children on the island, using any number of different ways to go about it for a long time.
And then add a couple trillion.
Yeah, the development of the offshore tax shelter certainly didn't help, in that the focus was always on finance at a certain point. Really, from the 1960s on, there was much more of a focus on finance. It really took off, from what I understand, in the 70s. Ted Heath was a huge proponent of the island not being included in the EU, being its own sort of autonomous entity, to serve as a convenient offshore tax shelter to the wealthy in England. And Ted Heath spent a lot of time on the island, and he was even accused of engaging in abuse of children by a number of people I've interviewed on the island. One woman who said she saw several children get onto his yacht and then less children come back, which has been a report that's really dogged his legacy ever since he passed away.
Who is this Heath?
Ted Heath, the former Prime Minister of England.
Oh, the former Prime Minister.
You would ask him about powerful people who had been implicated in the island's abuse.
Yeah.
So he might be maybe the highest level example of somebody who was implicated in abuse.
I forget. What years was he Prime Minister?
You know what? Hold on. I will check, because that was a little before my time. So he passed away. I also want to note when he passed away. I want to get this right. He was from, hold on. The years were 1970 to 1974. He was in office. and he died in July 2005. According to the police on the island of Jersey, he spent so much time in Jersey at the end of his life that the police had to create a special plan in case he died on the island, because they didn't have a contingency for what do you do if a prime minister dies on the island and has to be brought, you know, home to England.
Huh. There's a lot going on in this story.
There's too much going on, obviously. And it's part of the reason I haven't finished writing my book about Jersey, is there are a lot of people still too afraid to speak. And I do have a lot of people who do speak to me, but don't want to speak on the record. And some survivors who are also brought to the children's home after it closed in 1986 and were continued to be abused. Multiple children, multiple groups of people with high-ranking people on the island. And not just high-ranking people on the island involved, but the island's police. One woman told me her own relative, a police officer, was involved in bringing children to the children's home, including herself, for abuse. And there were several others that came forward about what happened to them at Hot De La Guerra. And after the home closed, it seemed people were really attached to the idea of bringing children to this location and engaging in crimes.
So, Leah, you were saying that that Haute La Garenne is a place that people had come back to continue to commit these crimes.
Yeah, even after the children's home closed, survivors have told me about being brought there against their will. In many cases, they were drugged and brought there by high-ranking people or people in authority on the island, like police officers or well-connected people, for abuse inside the building. And it's a concern that people seem to be attached to the children's home as a location for abuse. It just seems that there appears to be a focus to encouraging children to use the building and to be in the building, even to this day. When the UK judge in 2017 recommended the building be demolished because of the way it had been used to hurt children, there was a huge campaign to save the building, and the building has been preserved, but they turned it into a youth hostel. So now they're continuing to have children.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
I couldn't believe it either. I out of all the things you could do with a building, why would you still have children going into a building where horrible crimes against children took place?
It seems counterintuitive, you know, when you put it like that. Is there a resolution here? I know that's an unfair question, given what you've just described and how broad it is. I mean, if you're talking about somewhere between the Nazis' industrial-scale child abuse and $2 trillion, you know, and the monarchy, and maybe some Russia, there's a lot to talk about. But are we getting to an inflection point here, or is this, you know, something's up here? Are you know, you know, we gonna is the system ready for the truth about this to come out? I guess is the question that I'm asking.
That's a great question, and I heard an interview recently where someone said, and I thought this was very intuitive. They said, "I'm not buying that the reason why child abuse on the island was covered up for so long was simply to protect the island's reputation and its tax shelter status, right? Because high-level, wealthy clientele aren't necessarily going to want to bring their money to a place known for child abuse. It is common for officials on the island, including in the film that I just worked on that was released this past month, to say child abuse happens everywhere, we're no different than anywhere else. And they try to first make a statement that normalizes child abuse by saying it happens everywhere, which is concerning enough.
Yeah.
But the big concern is if they really do accept that child abuse can happen and does happen in places around the world, then they should be able to accept that just like places around the world, they can bring perpetrators to justice. And that seems to be the area Jersey struggles in. And that is what makes them so noteworthy
is this stubbornness about actually bringing perpetrators to justice once they've identified them. When you've had multiple children and survivors identifying the same people over and over again, and nothing is done, that does not make them like everywhere. It makes them very different. And I think that is what's caught a lot of people's attention, is what is the real reason to not bring perpetrators to justice? Yes, many of them are high level. A lot of them are connected to the financial industry or other positions of power in government, or in other positions of authority. However, you can't just hold it off forever. At the time of Hot de la Guerra, and there were about 200 different survivors who came forward reporting over 150 different perpetrators. It's a lot of people. It's also a lot of perpetrators per survivor. It's an awful lot of people. So I think that it is true that there needs to be some soul searching. And as far as solution, that's what the fourth estate is for. Now, I'm a journalist. And so through my eyes, reporting the truth is really one of the best solutions. And the film was to try to really bring a lot of that truth to light, the film that you talked about at the beginning of this interview, and to hear from survivors directly, let them tell their stories, let their voices be heard, because they've been silenced. And so a big part of the solution is allowing them to speak.
So you've got a custom-made visa just for you. And hundreds of people that want to tell their story. So,
yeah, although I will say they took the visa away again as soon as the judge finished the child abuse inquiry in 2017. So my visa was up for renewal and they declined to renew it.
What year was that they declined?
Let's see, that must have been the end of 2017. It was shortly after the inquiry had closed. They were very nice to me during the inquiry because they knew they were being watched.
Huh.
The inquiry closed. I went to renew it, and they said they wanted to see a copy of my book draft if I wanted to renew my visa, which is, as you know, I'm an American journalist, completely out of the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of editorial thing might go with your editor, you know, at the publisher. And even then you might have, you know, some opinions, but,
yeah. Also, why would you need to read the draft of my book?
What would it
to
matter?
Give me my visa renewal? Yeah. Why would you need to do that? You would not need to do that.
So there's for people who are interested in more, and it looks like you could go at any angle, that there's a film right now available. It's on YouTube, isn't it?
It's been up on YouTube and down occasionally. You can find this film on BBC Storyville. If you just Google BBC Storyville and go to the BBC iPlayer, you can watch it there. I think it will get wider circulation, but right now, if you were not in Great Britain, you'd want to view it through a VPN, ideally, to see the film.
And that's Dark Secrets of a Trillion Dollar Island. Get in?
Yes. Yeah, that's the name of the film. And in addition, I just put out an article that looks at one of the largest document leaks we have seen on any tax shelter in a very long time on the island of Jersey, and the implications for that as well, which have global implications because so many people were exposed by it.
And how was that discovered?
And I should mention the article is an Institutional Investor. So
okay.
You can also see it on my website, leahmcgrathgoodman.com.
And what's the name of the article?
It is called The Heiress, the Queen, and the Trillion Dollar Tax Shelter. Yes, they're very they're very bejeweled titles, these films and these stories. But it's about a couple that stumbled on this gigantic cache of documents on the island of Jersey in a squash court of this huge manor house. And they didn't realize at first what they had stumbled onto, but as they looked through the documents, they realized that this was the private documents for a trust company that was, according to them, laundering money for decades on the island for people all around the world.
Well, that's not a big deal at all. That won't have global implications. All righty then. So we got the film Dark Secrets of a $1 trillion Island, your latest story in Institutional Investor, The Heiress, The Queen, The $1 trillion Tax Shelter. Where can people find you on the internet webs and on the Twitters?
On Twitter, I'm at truth_eater. That's my handle. And online, it's leahmcgrathgoodman.com. And I'm very interested in writing about complicated issues, especially when human rights are involved. But my realm really is in the world of high finance, and then how it affects regular people, like the people on the island of Jersey. But I do look at a lot of issues that affect regular people globally. Jersey just happens to be maybe one of the more complex stories of my career.
I think it would be one of the most complex stories of anyone's career. So thank you for sharing that with us. And we look forward to following up on this.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.